sometimes you kind of go through practice, you're like, well, nothing's really changed. We're kind of going at status quo, right? We're cruising along in third gear. Everything is fine. And then sometimes you're like, oh my goodness, there's stuff coming from the left and the right. And there's a lot of changes. We recently did the update on the Alps trial. We did the hot off the press new developments in OBGYN news just a couple of days ago. And now, yet again, on today, which is April the 29th, 2024, ACOG has released a new practice clinical guidance. Okay, this is a practice update surrounding the diagnostic criteria for intra-amniotic infection. I'm not going to tell you what it is right now. You got to listen to the rest of the episode, but this is a welcome revision. Now, the original practice guidance on suspected intra-amniotic infection, that still stands. And of course, we're going to go through that in this episode. But there's a big change here to the diagnostic criteria for suspected IAI. And it's very welcome because sometimes, and it's happened to me, where we're looking at a strip, we're like, oh my gosh, it's fetal tachycardia, but nothing else is really going on. Of course, she's got leukocytosis because she's in labor. So that's kind of hard to read. We're like, I don't know, you know, is it or is it not intra-amniotic infection when there is normal temperature? Well, there it is. There is a spoiler. I'm going to get into this in just a moment. Because as maternal morbidity and mortality, of course, has been highlighted over the last several years, this is one of the things that may have put people behind the ball. Because it's happened to me where, you know, we've seen this fetal tachycardia, maybe some maternal leukocytosis, which we know can be a normal stress response in labor, maybe some uterine tenderness, but of course that's subjective and is based on BMI. If they have higher BMI, you may not be able to appreciate uterine fundal tenderness on palpation. Like, I don't know, she's afebrile though, so can she really have suspected IAI? And some of those patients may not get timely administration of much needed antibiotics. So that's the niche here. That's the crux of the issue. Because as of April 28th, 2024, just yesterday, most of the diagnostic criterion had one foundational word: fever. Fever. And so that's what we're going to talk about in this episode. Is fever a requirement for suspected IAI? Ooh, it's good stuff, everybody. So that came out again today on April 29th, 2024, as a new ACOG practice update. So let's get into this new update right now. Just trying to keep everyone up to date on evidence-based practice because medicine moves real fast. This is Clinical Pearls.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
I was just told by my producer of this, hey, stop saying today, that this was released today, right? I said this was released today, April the 29th, 2024. And his reason for saying that is valid. He's like, man, what if they listen to that next month? What if they listen to that in 2 months? It's not the day they're listening to it. To which I rebutted, that's why I gave the date, brother. That's why I always say, if I say I'm recording this today, I always give the day of the message. So right now we're recording this, which is the same day of ACOG's release of ACOG's clinical practice update on the criteria for suspected diagnosis of IAI, and the date is April the 29th, 2024. So if you're listening to this, let's say in June, you're like, oh, they just released it today in June? No, today, April the 29th, 2024. This is just an update. It doesn't remove the previous committee opinion on this, which was committee opinion 712 from the college. That was intrapartum management of intraneotic infection. This is an update to that, all right? So again, this is its own standalone piece. It's ACOG clinical practice update on the criteria for suspected diagnosis of intramneotic infection, but it's kind of an addendum, okay, or an add-on to committee opinion 712, which was the original intrapartum management of intraamniotic infection. Now, if you remember that committee opinion, which we've covered many times before on 712, it lists that intraamniotic or intrapartum fever is kind of the foundational marker here on the three different varieties of presentation, okay? So let's just remind ourselves of what this is. So we've covered all this before. The first typical clinical case is isolated maternal fever. And I'll define that in a minute, but that's, you know, oh my gosh, hey, she's got a temperature elevation, and there's no tachycardia, there's no uterine tenderness, there's no foul-smelling lochia. The leukocytosis is appropriate for labor. So like, man, I don't know, it's isolated maternal fever. And right now, because we don't have a way to figure out if that is truly infectious or if it's neuraxial induced, like from a spinal or epidural, we just got to treat it like IAI, okay? So the first clinical presentation of intrapartum suspected intraamniotic infection is the isolated maternal fever. That's nothing new. The second is truly suspected intraamniotic infection, which is the addition of fever plus one or more additional criteria. So maternal leukocytosis, purulent cervical drainage, or fetal tachycardia. But to have suspected intraamniotic infection, if you go back to 712 back in 2017, it's interesting that it states, quote, for suspected intraamniotic infection, that includes maternal intrapartum fever and then one or more of the following, which we've already stated, the leukocytosis, purulent cervical drainage, or fetal tachycardia. But did you all get that? It includes maternal intrapartum fever. And then the third is confirmed intraamniotic infection, which we typically don't do because that would include something like Gram stain or checking interleukins or glucose level of tapped amniotic fluid. And most of us don't do that. Or most commonly, that's placental pathology that demonstrates histological evidence of placental infection or inflammation. Hence, chorioamnionitis in its strictest term, right? Because that's a pathological term, inflammation histologically of the placenta and or truly culture positive infection, okay? However, notice that of the two main clinical presentations of the three, because one is confirmed intraamniotic infection, which either TAP or is post-delivery with histological examination of the placenta. But the main issue with isolated maternal fever or suspected intraamniotic infection was what? The daggone fever. I mean, that was like the sine qua non, like, right, the without doubt that there's some kind of infectious process going on. In the light of the fact that we can't yet discriminate when it's isolated maternal fever not caused by an infectious agent. So you're like, if there is fever, then there likely is something ill at play. So by the reverse of that, if there is the absence of fever, does that mean that she is in the clear? And that's what caused a lot of real world clinical conundrums here and perhaps some disagreement in a care team. We're like, wait, you want to give her antibiotics, but she's afebrile. Well, I know she's afebrile, but the baby has tachycardia and the amniotic fluid smells horrible. Well, but she doesn't have fever. Y'all get this. Now, I understand that the majority of people wouldn't wait for the fever if there's maternal tachycardia, uterine tenderness, and foul-smelling amniotic fluid. Most would give antibiotics based on that. However, it's not supported. Technically, if you go into the college bulletin from 2017, fever was kind of the foundational criteria there. So this is why this new update is pretty impactful, because now it removes that restriction, if you will, or a diagnostic, you know, sine qua non without a doubt. Because the truth is, just because you have fever doesn't really mean that she has an intramyotic infection. I mean, what if there is a buttocks abscess? I mean, whatever. I know it sounds kind of silly, but honestly, just because she has fever doesn't mean it's intrauterine. And just because she does not have fever doesn't mean she does not have an intrauterine infection. Wow. All right. So again, nothing of that is mind-blowing. We all get that. But it's nice to now have a clinical update to have that in text. So if somebody ever says, oh, I can't believe you, that's not good antibiotic stewardship. You used antibiotics and she was afebrile. I sure did, because you do not have to have fever. That can come later, and meanwhile, you get behind the ball, okay? This is why, remember, that maternal sepsis is a leading cause of maternal mortality, and so you've got to get on top of that quickly. This is why we don't play with isolated maternal fever. So even though isolated maternal fever can be an epidural reaction, and I've got an episode on that, right? Isolated maternal fever, is it the epidural or is it a true infection? The answer is we don't really have a way to distinguish one or the other, so treat her like it's intramyotic infection so we don't get behind the ball. But in general, I remember I said I was going to define that, so I did not forget. Let me just give you that diagnosis of isolated maternal fever based on the specific temperature cutoffs, okay? Now, remember, this is this temperature cutoff with nothing else going on, hence isolated maternal fever. That is either an oral temperature of 39 degrees Celsius one time or higher, or a temperature between 38 and 38.9 that persists when the temperature is taken again after 30 minutes without an antipyretic. Okay, so you can't go, oh, temperature 38.5, but there's nothing else going on. Here, take this 1 gram of Tylenol, then let me check it again. No, no, no. If you're going to let it declare, you got to let it declare. So isolated maternal fever was 39 degrees Celsius or higher, without anything else going on, or an oral temperature of 38 to 38.9 that persists when the temperature is taken again after 30 minutes, okay? Now, that's one of the issues here. That's very easy. That's maternal fever. That's when she has it. The issue comes in here for that suspected intramyotic infection that's now been expanded. All right. So before, remember, we just said it a little while ago that it was fever plus another clinical symptom. But that criterion of fever is now taken away. This is a big deal, guys. So let me read you the excerpt from the college and I'll tell you where this reference came from. But it's stuff that we've all seen. Even in gynecology, right, that sometimes some of the sickest patients are like, oh, my gosh, she's not only does she not have fever, but she actually could have a little bit of hypothermia because she's so sick, like she's way past the fever part. OK, so, yes, sepsis and a certain percentage of sepsis patients may not even be febrile. OK, so that's the catch. So remember that like in a separate yet related issue, pyelonephritis in pregnancy. Right. It's two of three issues, fever, dirty urine, and causal vertebral angle tenderness. Any two of those three, and it may not be fever, but if you've got CVAT that's real and not, you know, oh, that hurts when you hit me, like true CVAT and dirty urine, that's enough for pylo. So having the restriction that you have to have fever to be considered, you know, sick or infected, it makes sense, but it's too strict. So if we have clinical judgment, this opens up the door for the gestalt, right? The entire image, a view of the patient, then we can get more timely interventions before the patient has a downward spiral. And then we go, oh, she's getting really sick. I guess she was septic after all. Yeah, I think. So this is to try to be in front of the issue rather than behind it. One of the main studies that was used for this justification of removing fever, we can look at a variety of publications from family medicine, from internal medicine, from infectious disease. They all say the same things, that fever is not the absolute requirement to be really sick. Okay. Now, most people who are really sick tend to have fever from an infectious source, but it doesn't have to be there. So ACOG quotes a publication from the Green Journal from 2015 by Bauer et al., the title of which was Maternal Deaths Due to Sepsis in the State of Michigan, spanning 1999 to 2006. Okay, did everybody get that? So this is kind of the foundational piece, even though ACOG has other references. But this is the one that they go to go, look, man, when we talk about maternal death, not just occurrence of sepsis, but death, According to this one state's evaluation, 1999 to 2006, there's some important lessons here that we've always known, but it's good to now have in print, okay? So that you don't get to that conversation with your partner on call or nurse administration or an attending who says, you want to start antibiotics, she's afebrile. And your answer is, you're absolutely right, she's afebrile. However, because of the new clinical update from ACOG and because the baby has tachycardia and she has uterine tenderness, I'm going to say that that's infected and we're giving her antibiotics. And I'm backed by the college. Good for you. Or she has uterine tenderness, tachycardia. That amniotic fluid is just straight up rank. I mean, there's something not right in there. I'm giving her antibiotics, regardless of what her temperature says. Now ACOG says, yeah, that's legit. Now, I understand I would totally get antibiotics for that indication without fever anyway. I mean, I'm just going to do it because it makes clinical sense. But it wasn't in the ACOG guidance, all right? Now it is. So, again, released on April the 29th, 2024. Let me read you this quick excerpt. Then we're going to be done here because this is just a practice update, all right? And then I'll drive this home. But before I do that, let me just give a little side note here. So I was on the call, or we were on the OB consensus meeting when this update was being discussed, all right? Now, you read the update, and it's relatively short. It just kind of gets right to it. I want you all to know that, I mean, these discussions and the studies that were brought up took some time. I mean, it was like, oh, sure. Well, what about this other data? What does this show? And what's the percentage of patients who don't have fever? Guys, I want you to know that there really are some truly dedicated people here trying to make the right call here. And so then at the end, of course, everybody takes a consensus vote, says, yep, let's pass this forward. Of course, it goes to Dr. Zahn as final word. All to say, I'm so proud to see the behind-the-scenes stuff. What a gift. I consider that a gift. I know it's really nerdy, but I love seeing these discussions and people vested, honestly, in trying to move the needle, trying to change things. Otherwise, people are like, nah, committee opinion 20 in 2017. We already talked about that. Just leave it in there. It's in committee opinion 712. It's fine. Just leave it alone. No, we've got it. We've got to be more proactive. So anyway, just kudos to the OB Clinical Care Consensus Committee, really for having their heart in the right place. Thank you for being part of our podcast family. We really are grateful and thankful that you've chosen to take this journey of medical education with us. You're listening to Clinical Pearls. So the excerpt from this practice update reads, it may not be possible to exclude the diagnosis of suspected intramyotic infection based on the absence of maternal fever. Similarly, isolated maternal fever is not always associated with or definitely predictive of intramyotic infection, end quote. Yeah, we've already covered that, right? So fever doesn't always mean that she has an IAI, and the absence of it doesn't mean that she does not. Okay, we've already established that. But here's where the numbers come in that are very sobering. ACOG continues to state, quote, it's important to note that a recent study of maternal death due to sepsis, which we just gave that reference for, suspects the concept that maternal fever may not uniformly be present in cases of intramyotic infection. So listen to these numbers, all right? In that study, this is the Michigan study, 18% of the patients who died, remember they all had sepsis, were found on post-mortem review to have had an intramyotic infection. So let's stop there. So these are patients who had sepsis. Oh my gosh, they died, that mortality. And you're like, well, how many of that was IAI? 18%, which means that the rest had something else. Right, so that's why it's important, man. Urosepsis, was that an issue? Was it septic from bad abscess? Whatever. So I don't want to get into that other publication because I'm focusing here on IAI. But in this review from Michigan, 18% of patients who died from sepsis had IAI. Now check this out. 73% of these study patients were afebrile on presentation. So 73% were afebrile on presentation. 25% never developed a fever during the hospitalization at all, and 9% were hypothermic. Now remember, all of them went on to die. So do y'all get this, guys? So the next time, and I'm not calling out anybody. Let's just say there's an attending, right? So you're a senior resident. You're like, hey, I'm starting antibiotics. I suspect IAI clinically, even though she's afebrile. That attending goes, nope, got to wait for fever. You now, in a professional way, go, ma'am, sir, I'm not doing that because I have true clinical markers here. I suspect that there's something going on clinically. An absence of fever does not mean absence of infection. Absence of fever does not mean absence of infection. So I would like to start on antibiotics based on the ACOG practice bulletin alert, the update from April the 29th, 2024. There you go. So, and that was the thing. A lot of people waited. Well, she's not. Oh, now she's febrile. Well, now baby's been cooking in there for several hours. I don't know. I'm just saying. And we've got him behind. So with all that in pro-inflammatory cascade, the interleukin effect, the maternal temperature, and we know how that affects a baby's potentially adverse effect on neurodevelopment. So get ahead of it. So 18%, according to this review, patients who had sepsis were found to have an IAI. However, 73% of those study patients were afebrile in presentation, 25% never developed a fever, and 9% were hypothermic. This is talking about the entire patient study there from Michigan. Now, the ACOG goes on to say, quote, although not all patients with sepsis had intra-amniotic infection, this study does reinforce the concept that fever may not always be present in intra-amniotic infection and cannot be relied on as a uniformly present diagnostic criterion for severe maternal infection, end quote. So if you suspect it, get on top of it. Give those empiric antibiotics according to guideline, because we'd rather, in this case, potentially overtreat than undertreat. The final clinical recommendation from the college is, although the diagnosis of suspected intra-amniotic infection frequently includes maternal fever as a clinical criterion, scenarios exist in which fever in patients with intra-amniotic infection is not uniformly present. The patient's clinical situation should be individualized based on their presentation and evaluation, thereby enabling indicated discussions and therapeutic interventions with the goal of minimizing the patient's risks for severe morbidity and mortality. So, how nice is that? That if you've got fever, that's one thing, but if you don't and you suspect an infectious etiology, then get on top of that and work on that quickly. Podcast family, as we end this very targeted clinical practice update, remember this as the take-home message. The diagnosis of suspected IAI can be made in the absence of maternal fever when other associated clinical signs and symptoms are present, end quote. Now, to you and I, we read that as duh, but I'm telling you, I have heard these discussions, not just here in my current hospital, but in another teaching hospital in Dallas, where this issue of, but she's afebrile, where that was a stumbling block to somebody. Well, now that stumbling block can be really reduced to the level of the ground and no longer an obstacle because it has now been relaxed, it's been softened, and the diagnosis of suspected IAI is now softer and broader to be more encompassing of clinical factors, even with the absence of fever. All right, podcast family, let's bring it home. All right, podcast family, that brings us to a wrap. As always, we're thankful for you, and we're glad you're part of our podcast community. We'll see you on another episode of Clinical Pearls.